Fred Film Radio, Turin Film Festival, Italy.
Angela Cerbi, Fred Film Radio from the Torino Film Festival, here with Lucio Castro, director of Fin de Siglo, End of the Century. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Your film is here in competition. This is your first feature, and it's difficult to tell. It's a love story, let's say it.
Yeah.
It's a love story with different time frames, with different time sequences, and it's a very touching and realistic story.
Yeah.
What brought you to tell us this story in such a way, and then we will dwell into it.
Okay. Yeah, the story started in a very simple way, honestly. I just thought of the title, you know, Fin de Siglo, which means end of the century. I didn't know why that title came to my mind, so I just sat to write it. I usually write this way. I start writing without knowing what's going to happen. I don't write from notes. I don't have a structure before. So I just thought of like the most archetypal, you know, beginning of any novel, which is like a character arrives in a city, you know. So then I just followed him, you know. It's just like, okay, he arrives by train, which is also very literary. People now arrive by plane. So he arrives by train in a city he doesn't know very well. He checks in an Airbnb, which is also of our times. He looks in the fridge. He looks at the books in the Airbnb, which are always very weird. You know, it's always a few books that people leave. He goes in the bathroom, leaves his stuff. Goes to explore the city that he doesn't know, and then eventually he connects with this other character. They have sex, then they go for cheese and wine, and then once they're talking, they realize that they met 20 years before. So then I just went back to invent that first beginning,
The fridge is very important.
Yeah.
You know, because the fridge is the sign of the time passing.
Yeah.
The fridge gives us the hint of where we are, in time of which part of the narrative we are into, and at that point, I mean, you told us exactly how the film starts, and then up to that point, everything is okay. Mm-hmm. From that point on, your narrative starts to go back and forth, back and forth, and which is very fascinating, but it could be very risky for us watching it, because at some point you could get lost into it, which is, I think, maybe one of your purposes, to get ourselves lost in the film.
Yeah.
But weren't you afraid that this could have been too complicated? How did you manage it to make it more understandable?
Right. Thank you for noticing the fridge. For sure, it's one of my favorite parts. I like when objects are treated in films the same as characters. You know, to me, like everything that you see, like a book, a bottle of beer, everything has almost the same level. And it is definitely insinuates or shows that this placement that they're in time. But being a fridge, you know, it's like something that it's so like almost like, you know, it's the most common thing in the world to me. It was like something like, you know, interesting about that. I wasn't scared of people not knowing where they were. I was actually aware that they were and I was excited for it because I was, you know, it's the way I did it, basically the way I experienced time. You know, I'm talking to you now, but maybe I'm remembering something that I did this morning, and then maybe I'm planning what I'm going to have after this, you know, or a coffee or whatever. So we live in between these three times, you know, always. And it's not announced. It's not like, okay, in my mind it says 3 minutes and a half ago I did this, or I mean 2 minutes. You know, we don't announce the way we experience time. So I thought it would be interesting to do that, but in a film. Also, the film, I think, has, you're right, the shift is at first jarring or confusing, but then once you understand the story and what they're talking about, the characters, you know that they are in a different time, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know, it's fine. You're just hearing people experiencing something, you know, which is also okay. But yeah, I like as a viewer when I'm not fed everything. You know, the director doesn't tell me what to think.
You have to work on it.
Exactly.
But when
he gives me the chance to work, and I feel like I'm treating better. You know, that if they tell me what to feel now, and they put a sad music, cry. You know, I usually reject that when someone pushes me in everything in life. When somebody pushes me in one direction, I kind of like, you know, push backwards. So I feel like the film allows the viewer to not build their own story, because of course the story is quite clear, I think, to me, but it has these ambivalences and ambiguities with time and space that the viewer can then like start like, you know, putting their own experiences in it.
Did you have any kind of reference in mind when shooting?
Yeah.
Or to you know, take inspiration from?
Yeah, for sure. We were watching with the DP and the actors The Antonioni's The Eclipse, mm-hmm. Which is one of my favorite films. I mean, I love Antonioni in general. I watch all his movies every year. And Romer's A Summer Tale. The beginning has a lot of Romer of that too. There's a German director now that I discovered a film that I really loved called The Dreamlike Path and Marseille also by her. She's called Angela Schanelek. I feel like these three directors were pretty much in our minds before shooting it. But of course, when we shot it, it became their own things because, you know, the actors are so much themselves that it became about them. Mm-hmm. Some people see the Linklater trilogy because of the two actors in a summer town, you know. I like that movie. I like those three movies. But honestly, that wasn't...
It wasn't your...
No, I actually haven't seen it in a long time. Yeah.
And talking about the actors, there is a very specific and visible connection between the two actors. Mm-hmm. It's like they rehearse a lot. I don't know if you did a lot of rehearsal or not, but they are like very natural and you cannot think of them being actors.
Yeah.
Like you were spying on an actual love story between two. That's two great. Men. So how did you work with them to make them so real?
Yeah, thank you for that. That's great that you think that. No, honestly, they met before. There was a problem with flight, so they met the night before shooting.
Okay. So they are very good actors.
Exactly, exactly. So they're just very good. I mean, usually people ask me about the chemistry, you know, how long they've met before. They worked a lot. And my answer is always, you know, they're just smart actors. You know, I feel like, if you're a smart actor, you can fake chemistry even with an actor you hate. Mm. And if you're a bad actor, you cannot show chemistry even with someone you love. Mm. You know, so they're just great actors. We did talk about many things. For example, the switch in time, the sex scenes where they were a little bit nervous, not because of any moral concerns, but just like, you know, the way it is a very uncomfortable. So they're uncomfortable scenes to shoot because they're two naked people. You know, we're not used to being naked, unless you're a porn actor, which is maybe they are. But I don't know.
They are. Exactly. It's not the case.
Exactly, not the case. So it was more about like, you know, let's do it. So what we did is basically the actor had done a film before where the director had told him, just with him and the actress, just do pretend like you're having sex and I'm going to just steal shots. And then when he saw the final movie, it was just like three shots. And he was like, you should have told me those three shots instead of, we wasted so much time. And I would have been much better in those three shots. So that's what we did. We like planned each shot exactly. You know, we're going to see from here to here. And it was like, go and stop, you know. So they were very fast to shoot, honestly. But they were very planned beforehand. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And there is the sex parts are really sexy, mm-hmm. and really intimate too. But there is no, it's love making. It's mm-hmm. not sex making.
Yeah.
This is what it came out. So,
yeah.
So this method you have works.
Okay.
So you just noted it that for right, next time, right. So you know that those sex scenes shot in that way, they works a lot. There is, I was talking with friends that, mm-hmm. because I saw the movie in London, and so I sent people, friends of mine, just go watch the films.
Thank you.
And they were all fascinated but concerned about the ending. Uh-huh. Because the ending is an ending that gives you, as a viewer, 100 possible mm-hmm. scenarios that you have to pick your own. And you decided to close the film not on them, but on the city.
Mm-hmm.
So you start with the city, and you have you show Barcelona with great love, mm-hmm. with great attention to details.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You love the city that much.
I didn't know the city when I wrote it. Actually, mm-hmm. I wrote it because I wanted to invent. Like if I would have, you know, I was born in Buenos Aires, but I live in New York. If I had written about those two cities, it would have been hard for me to understand, to like be a tourist, you know, to mm-hmm. see it with tourist eyes. Like if I land in New York, I guess I'd take an Uber, you know. It's like mm-hmm. I can't imagine like an imaginary, you know, in Barcelona because I didn't know it. I could imagine like, oh, he arrives by train, or like I'd be much more. Imaginary, yeah.
It was more poetic for you.
Like if I think like, let's make a movie in Bucharest. I've never been to Bucharest. Okay, maybe Bucharest, it's at night and it's a dampy, you know, misty night. And here, you know, it enables me to like be more, you know, to invent more of my version of the city. But you're right. I mean, the film starts, to me, the film is like, it's a trip from exterior to interior. You know, the city at the beginning of the movie is very exterior, so it's, you see it from outside, and in the end, it's the city view for me viewed through Ocho's, you know, state, you know, the state of being. That's why I picked that like transition between night to morning, which is like everything. It's like that almost like that part of the city, that time of the day where everything's a little bit more like, you know. People are usually sleeping, and it's like that very like weird, strange light in between states. And when he's kind of like in between states as well, and the film to me goes from very concrete to very ethereal. You know, also the story. You know, the story is very concrete at the beginning, and then it becomes much more. Is it a dream? Is it not? Is it a possible thing? So to me, I like the transition, that tripping from like, you know, exterior, interior, concrete to ethereal. So to me, the movie has that transition. You're right, the ending can have many interpretations, and I love that when people have different interpretations. I, of course, had an intention when I did it, but I don't like saying my intention, because I feel like if I state it, then all the others will be, the ones that are not mine will be like, you know, cancelled, and of course. That I would have just written. But yeah, for sure, the film, I think, especially the ending, awakes many, many interpretations, and many, you know, people connect with their own experience, and they say or they think whatever connects with what they lived. You know?
And another thing that I found really, really fascinating and correct is that relationship between these two guys is really real. Mm-hmm. It's like a very gay relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
But that relation, the terms of that relationship can be exactly very easily transponded to a straight relationship. I mean, there is not... Yeah. The genre thing is not an issue.
Yeah.
It's like it's more universal and more general, which from a gay film point of view is not that common. Sometimes gay films are strictly... like dedicated or more understand for a gay viewer than a straight viewer, while yours is more universal. Mm. And my question is, were you thinking about this while you were shooting? Do you know that there was like this risk of being more categorized and more, you know, pigeonholed?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that too. I do think that lately there's like, you know, like in any, like, you know, there's a lot of like what we call gay films that I guess that are just destined to like, you know, the gay audience, which is of course a huge audience, and some of those films that are just made for that are fine. But I'm interested in film, you know. Mm-hmm. I love film. There's some African films that I love. There's many Japanese films, Chinese films that I love, that they speak very specific communities, you know. And I feel like the more specific you are, the more general. And I feel like that these gay films, to me, it's the opposite. It's actually, they present this generic gay sense of humor. And to me, that makes them like not that interesting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if a film is specific about something, you know, then it can be, to me, it's more appealing. And yeah, I mean, this film, as you said, it's of course a very gay film, of course, because it is. But it's what happens, and the mixing time, and their feeling of this moment of attraction. You know, many, many straight people, of course, and thank God, you know, told me that they connected with that as well, you know. The same way I connect with, like, so many straight films in my life.
Exactly. But normally when there is a gay story in a film, it's automatically categorized
as
a gay audience film, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah,
which is a pity
most of the time. Yeah. It's also a sign of our times that are changing and people can understand, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for Lucio Castro, director of Fin de Siglo, the end of the century, here in competition at the 37th Torino Film Festival. I'm Angelo Cerbi for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Thanks so much.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.